Runny, great, terrific. Well, this is supposed to be fun.
All right.
The amount of actual factual material and all of that we're going to dispense with in like 5 minutes. It's so simple. And the rest of it will be whatever you feel like talking about while I kind of lead it on.
Okay.
We were here, it's July, is it, have I made it to July 16th?
17th.
July 17th. We're talking to San Francisco Supervisor Tom Ammiano, and I just have everyone say their birth date into the tape recorder.
December 15th, 1941.
1941, and where were you born?
Newark, New Jersey.
And what did your parents do while you were growing up?
My mother worked as a cafeteria lady for the telephone company, and my father was a cab driver.
And did you go to high school there?
Yeah, I went to Catholic high school, Catholic grammar school, and okay. Catholic college.
And what college did you go to?
Seton Hall.
And when did you graduate?
1963.
Uh-huh. And how did you first find out about IBS?
I saw a brochure on a bulletin board at San Francisco State when I was going there. Mm-hmm.
And what made that announcement look interesting to you?
I wanted to get out of the country, and I had tried after graduation to join the Peace Corps and got as far as the training in Indiana to go to Thailand, and I was what they call euphemistically deselected.
You were deselected?
Yes, ostensibly because of asthma, but I think there was quite a gap in the class differences between where I was from and where most of the other group was from.
Really?
Plus, I think I was a little too effeminate for them. I think they had a big worry about that. Uh-huh. And so I got deselected, and I came to California where I had spent the summer. Uh-huh. The year before at a camp for the handicapped, and I started to work there.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to Berkeley and San Francisco, not just to live and work.
Uh-huh.
And then I started San Francisco, that was 1963, and then in 1964 I decided to go to try to get my master's at San Francisco State.
Mm-hmm.
So while meandering around the halls of San Francisco State, while I was just finishing up my master's in 65, mm-hmm. I saw the brochure. Mm-hmm. So I wrote away and had
right.
an interview.
Was the draft a factor?
I was extreme. It was fortuitous. It was in 1963, I was 21, and Kennedy had not yet been assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
It happened that November.
Mm-hmm.
And I was from Montclair, New Jersey, and I wasn't rich, but Montclair, there was Montclair and Upper Montclair. And Upper Montclair was supposed to be a post office designation, but, you know, nobody of color, mm-hmm. except servants, lived in Upper Montclair. I lived in what they called Lower Montclair, de facto Lower Montclair. And that had influence on who was drafted,
mm-hmm.
somehow. So, I mean, I think they went after more of the blacks who lived in Montclair, so that was one factor.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy had not been assassinated. Vietnam was percolating, but not overwhelming yet. And then there was already like exemptions. If you were married, no matter how old you were,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't get drafted. There was a softening around draftings. And so I was in California. They wrote me the letter.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason, they said, that we shouldn't draft you?
Mm-hmm.
Or why should you not be 1A?
Mm-hmm.
And I just wrote back, well, I have asthma. I didn't know what else to write. They wrote back, can you get us a note that you have asthma?
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote to the doctor. The doctor said Tom Ammiano has asthma, and 2 weeks later I got a thing that said I was 4F,
mm-hmm.
and that was dangerous to put out to many males in my age group,
mm-hmm.
who that's all they did in those days was sweat the draft.
Mm-hmm.
How the fuck did you get 4F? I think the irony now is being openly gay. I could have gone out at them, but God forbid that I would have said anything.
Yes.
So that was weird. So I was 4F.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so this appeal to leave, I always had anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have a lot of money, and, you know, and nobody wanted to go to Vietnam.
That's actually the question. Can you think about why you had this desire to go overseas?
Well, I mean, I always had
uh-huh.
to travel because I came from Newark, New Jersey,
right.
which is very constricted.
Uh-huh.
San Francisco was great, but it still was. And then I had that almost a taste of the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost made it. And it did appeal to my...
Uh-huh.
Some of the Catholic upbringing was good, and, you know, some of it wasn't. But the good part was that you helped people. I always liked that. So that wasn't a stretch. And then to get travel for it seemed like it, because I never thought I would have money. So I thought, well, that's good. You know, and it had a youth appeal, and I was young.
So these are the factors that led you applying for the Peace Corps.
Yes.
And then the Peace Corps...
I carried over to IBS because I was
IBS.
Cheated at that. I thought, well, yeah. How am I going to do this? I'm never going to have any money. I don't... And it was perfect, and I'll tell you something I shouldn't have done, but years later, in Saigon, I was trapped in an office. They locked me and an interpreter in the office when I was learning Vietnamese. And we were there for an hour and a half because the phones weren't working. And so I went through the files, of course, and there was my file. And it said that the interviewer said that I was a very strange, high-strung person. And basically at the end, I think the guy was trying to be nice. I think it was Clark somebody. Just said, well, if he would shave his beard, I suppose, since nobody else is applying this year. I don't know, it was like that. So I was weird, I guess, to them.
To them, yeah.
Well, they had a white Protestant, you know, nice kind of Quaker thing to them that was still there. And I'm sure, just being from New York, never mind.
That's true.
Being, you know, somewhat flamboyant and then working, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I remember the word, I don't think the word was weird because I think he was too nice, but a strange guy.
And did you know where you were going from the...
soon after that they wrote, I think, and they said, you know, you're going to be assigned to Vietnam and you have to come to Washington, D.C. For a, you know, whatever, couple of training. Yeah.
And did you know what you were going to do there?
I can't remember. I think it was to teach English, since I had had a teaching. By that time I had my master's.
Master's,
you know.
Great. Yeah. In English?
No, in special education.
Special education,
yeah.
Even better. And so you went to Washington. They didn't have Harper's Ferry then.
Yes, they did.
They did have Harper's Ferry. What year did you get
there? That was very nice, 1966.
Oh, that's right.
So they had Harper's Ferry, and there was the Vietnamese there, and I wasn't that political, and they had some of the Vietnamese establishment there, and I was very impressed by what they said, you know, we want to fight communism, you know, what did I know? So I said, well, that sounds good, and the only glitch for me was when I was in the graduate school, I did a little shoplifting, and I got caught. All your friends did it, but I got caught. Mm-hmm. So after, because IBS was so, and I love him for this, you know, podunk. It caught up to me, and it said, oh, you were arrested for shoplifting. I said, yeah, you know, but they said I didn't have to put it down. You know, that usual shit.
Uh-huh.
So they said, gee, this might be a glitch. Of course, the irony was everyone was stealing in Vietnam blind, but they had a glitch about me. So I had to not go over with my group until they figured out what to do with me. And I think I went home to New Jersey, and then there was this terrible wait. And going home to New Jersey, I can't simplify how terrible that was to go home to New Jersey. After all, I'd already sprung, you know, gone to... I thought this may be a redo of the Peace Corps, maybe I wasn't supposed to ever do anything like this. But they did call up and they said, well, fine, you know, it's not that big a deal. So I actually left by myself. I didn't go with the group. Mm-hmm. Got there late, was in all the Hong Kong and all the stops by myself. And then when I got there... there was a friend of mine, a woman friend of mine from New York, who had been in the Peace Corps. Mm-hmm. She got accepted when I wasn't accepted. Mm-hmm. She was in the Philippines, and then she took a job with the Army, and so that's why she was in Vietnam. Right. She was a civilian worker for the Army, mm-hmm. and she met me at the Tamarack in Tansin Yut, and with her big New York accent and you know, all the Jewish elan, and, you know, because I'm supposed to say Vietnam, a whole new world. Vietnam welcomer guy, the IVS guy, who was, I think, the same guy you're interviewing, was a little taken aback that there was this woman. Judith and I. And that's how I got to Vietnam. And that's why I was locked in the office, because I came so late that the group had already been assigned and had language training, so I got individual language training at the IVS house.
Right. And then you were assigned to?
I was assigned to Ninh Hoa, which is a provincial capital about an hour away from Nha Trang.
Okay.
And we used to say, we used to make a pun, instead of Vui Lam, we say Ninh Hoa is Vui, what was the word? See, I'm forgetting already. Mm-hmm. Anyway, dusty. Mm-hmm. You know, the word for dust and happiness was, so it was very dusty in Ninh Hoa. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was for about a year, and then I became a team leader in Nha Trang. And there was a mass exodus of people who had been there for a while. Almost everybody was new, and then we also were going to get kicked out. They wanted to kick us out. You know, Don had become active with the Tiger Cage expose.
Yes, uh-huh.
And there was a new influx of people from in Vietnam, in IBS, who weren't necessarily from Nebraska or Mennonites or that ilk, but they were a lot of fun. I guess Nassan hippies, you know, and they were there either to avoid the draft or to get out of the draft or because they believed in what IBS was doing. And IBS, I think, probably didn't have a lot of recruits. Mm-hmm. And they came with a new consciousness, which was basically that the war sucked and this and that and that. They weren't pacifistic. And it looks like the ambassador, I think it wasn't Bunker. Maybe it was. Bunker was there when I left. They basically asked IVS to leave, but they couldn't make us leave. They couldn't make it. Or I think I could be allowed to finish my tour. Or whoever was there could finish, but then you had to go. So I think people left. And I think that's why I became a team leader, because they had nobody else.
What year did you become a team leader?
67. So almost the whole last year. 67 to 68, I think I was a team leader, somewhere in there.
Okay, so you did the 2 years.
Yeah.
And for the first year,
I was a classroom teacher at Ninhwa High School with having the runs, and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it was 150 degrees, and 95 students going, "This is a dog, this is a dog," with a New Jersey accent. And then they gave me a bicycle, and I couldn't work the bike. You know, it would break, and then 1,000 students would go by laughing at me. Mm-hmm. But I had a little house, and I got to be very good friends with people around there. I mean, it was a great adventure. I mean, I have white guilt because it was an adventure. Mm-hmm. I could always leave. And my Vietnamese friends were always good about saying, you know, you could always leave. Mm-hmm. We like you, but we think your government sucks. And that was fine with me. But that's about as political as I got, except for seeing, really, that there was a lot more dimension to what was happening than what was presented by the ambassador to Vietnam.
For example?
Well, that it was a civil war, and there was good and bad on both sides. And that
you mean it wasn't just aggression from the north?
And that really good people did get killed and ripped off, and you know, innocently. And you know, the Koreans were there outside my town, and they were pretty cruel. Their armies are, you know, their mentality is different, and they were pretty cruel. And then there was a MACV there, and they thought I was totally from Mars. I mean, how could I be there and want to be there?
Did they ever, do you ever remember a conversation along those lines?
They were very civil. Yeah, they were curious. Then they appointed a USAID guy there, and he was quite put out, because he had worked with the Kennedys and this and that. And you know, how Ninhwa was actually a put down for me. It was a put down for him, but he planned to go, and he invited me to dinner once, just once. He said, "You mean you really eat with these people?" And now that, in a strange way, was good for me, because you know, you got depressed, you had culture shock. That he thought what I was doing was so you know, risk taking or noble. Yeah. That helped me. I thought, well, maybe I'm not so bad. And I think I actually belched at dinner, and he went crazy as if I had violated his mother on the table. I remember, I think Vietnam made people crazy too. If you were, and you were prone to be crazy, you got even crazier. Mm-hmm. And he asked me to leave. I mean, this is in the middle of Ninhwa. This is in Beacon Hill. Mm-hmm. And so, fine. And I slept home, and I never had any contact with him after that. And then I think they decided not to have you stay there anymore. It's a strange story.
No? Pretty typical.
Yeah.
When you were made team leader, what were the responsibilities? I mean, how did you carry the responsibility?
It's vague. It was, there was some administrative stuff, and it was checking on people.
Yeah.
So you'd fly out to whatever, and are you okay? And they say, my check didn't come, or somebody was sick, et cetera, and so forth. And then one of the more kind of negative things was, as new people came in, they would ask you what you thought. So, you know, if you didn't like somebody or thought somebody wasn't great, you said that, and then everybody knew you said that, and it was really, you know, the hierarchy at IVS was pretty loose, so it was kind of weird for me that young to be put in that position. And there was two guys that came over, they applied for Vietnam, and they were very tight, and I knew they weren't gay, that I knew, but there was some bond they had, and they were upper class white guys, and one had been a captain, and one had been something else, and all they asked of me was that when they got assigned, could they be close to each other? And what it turned out was that they were hooked on the stuff, because there's a lot of dope in Vietnam, and I never did any. I was totally innocent. I'm not bragging. I just didn't do any. I didn't know. You know, I'm glad I didn't know. And because, you know, some of the volunteers did. And that's why they came back, because the purity and the quality of the heroin that they got as GIs, and, you know, not like necessarily working class yet, but you know, they couldn't get it home. And they were connected. I mean, these guys had money, and they had gone to good colleges and things like that. That they joined IVS. So to be
how
back
did
to being that closer,
okay?
My God, you know, I never remember. It was toward the end of my thing.
Yeah. Wow.
Isn't that odd? But they wanted to be, and I knew, you know, I just knew they weren't gay. That wasn't the bond.
Yeah.
But there was a bond, and I couldn't figure it out, and it was the dope bond. They were probably doing it when I mean, I don't get it. But anyway, I always thought that was interesting. And then my townmate for a while, when I went to Ninhwa, there was somebody else already there, and basically I just, you know, we didn't get along. And he just said that he was there because he wanted to work for RFK. I'm not remembering all the letters. But anyway, there was a lot of money to be made in Vietnam for civilian construction companies and shit. And somehow he had applied and he didn't get it. So IVS was a conduit. Because I think a lot of, you know, they were naive about who they hired and stuff. And he said he wanted to go, so he went. And so basically he did a lot of black market shit and everything. And I was very glad he finally quit mm-hmm. IVS. Because even to me, mm-hmm. I had some standards. And I didn't like it.
It's self-selective.
And he always got laid and everything. And yeah. He's always trying to get me laid uh-huh. and, you know, Vietnamese pussy and all this stuff. And uh-huh. Here I am, the little fag, you know. I mean, so that was an issue. And he was very popular in the town with the Hu Ha family in the town, the Chinese pharmacy market family, who were very nice to me, but basically what he was doing on the side was business. Business, business. God knows what it is. So, you know, again, I mean, it takes a lot to offend me, but that offended me. And finally, he just quit on his own, which was really great for me. Then I was there by myself, which, you know, gets lonely, but I liked it, yeah. You know. I didn't have that thing over me.
Just for the fun of it, Ninhoa is Ninhoa.
Yeah, good. Ninhoa is, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is wonderful. This is kind of this is an interview on speed, and I'm enjoying every
yeah,
second of it.
Yeah, well, that's me.
And it's also the time we have. Why don't we just, I want to talk about three things, really. The Tet Offensive, your impressions of your total IVS experience, and how it might have influenced you later on.
Well, the Tet Offensive was... the family next door to me was very nice, and the father got in some kind of political trouble, and believe me, I was really naive. How did I know? Mm-hmm. So he was jailed, and he was jailed in Nha Trang. Mm-hmm. The family was upset, but they were always very protective of me, and I said, are you going to go visit them? And you know, that was like a naive question. Mm-hmm. If they went to visit him, they probably would have been kept in the jail. Mm-hmm. So I said I would go, and they were very grateful for that. Mm-hmm. Now, you remember what happened to Gidelson. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't that bubble, but you kind of thought, you know, you did have white skin privilege, mm-hmm. et cetera, and so forth. And I had run-ins with MPs and everything that I could tell you about if you want. So I went to visit the father, who was a really gentle, wonderful mm-hmm. man. Mm-hmm. Who knows what he was involved with?
Right.
I had no idea. And he was grateful. He was a little nervous for me that I came. I gave him a message from the family. The Vietnamese guards, you know, were very huffy towards mm-hmm. me. But at the same time, they took that step back that they usually did with Americans. You know, who was I? Was I CIA? Was I this? Was I that? You know, skinny kid, that's all I was. I didn't know anything, I was like being nice. So when I went back to that town, eventually I think he got released. Mm-hmm. So the night of the Tet Offensive, you know, the son came over, the older son, he said, oh, why don't I stay overnight tonight? I thought that was strange. We live right next door. I probably had invited him before, they never did. So I said, yeah, you want to stay overnight? I don't care, you have all this room. So we bullshitted, we did this, we did that, and he made up his pallet, and then I was going to go into the mosquito net. And we heard some noise, and he said, you know, I wonder if you would just indulge me, however he put it, mm-hmm. would you get under the bed? And I said, why? And he said, I think it'd be better if we did. And you know, I trusted him. Right. I said, sure. So then everything broke loose around us. Not so much right in Ninhoa, but, you know, the howitzers went off from the Korean camp, which was probably a few miles away, mm-hmm. and every time the howitzer went off, the back door would open, you know, for this Russian thing. And there was a lot of movement, and you could hear shouting occasionally, and I really did not know, mm-hmm. but they knew, mm-hmm. and they wanted to protect me. Mm-hmm. So the next day, he said, people are coming in from the countryside. Could they stay in your house? Well, obviously, I had this big house. For me, it was big, and for them, I said, of course. So they all came in. And the door was locked, and you know, it was mostly peasant families. And I think probably being in Ninhoa was safer than being in the countryside. Mm-hmm. And I started to piece it together, Tet this, Tet that. And that's when that night there was the big knock at the door, and there was Vietnamese I didn't recognize. It was probably northern, more northern. And that's when they said, you should just hide. And of course, that's when I went up in that water tower, and then they took care of everything, whatever happened, whatever. Internecine stuff happened. Mm-hmm. And then the next morning, by coincidence, a helicopter landed, an American helicopter landed in the soccer field across, and they said, we think you should go. Because, I mean, I got the vibe that the longer I was there, I was endangering them,
right.
too.
Right.
See, that's all this politicalization happens on the human level. Mm-hmm. That's how IVS affected me. Mm-hmm. That politics is local and politics is human. Mm-hmm. You know, that you can have this policy and that policy. But then there was the, you know, the Van Nguyen family next door. Mm-hmm. That's what Vietnam was. So then I ran across, and I thought they were going to shit, the GIC. I mean, here's this. And I said, where are you going? They said to me, "What?" I said, I need a ride to Nha Trang. They said, we're not going there, but we're going to Nha Trang. So I got in the helicopter. It was my first, I think, and my only helicopter ride in Vietnam, even though it was hell. And we went to Nha Trang, which was under siege, but, you know, a lot of the Tet stuff, I think more happened around me than that I was totally involved. Or even Nha Trang got hit, but not. So that was, and then of course my family, they all thought I was dead and all this stuff. It took obviously a little while to tell people that everybody, because I think the news was terrible in the States, which I never saw. They probably made it, you know, and they probably showed the bloodshed and stuff. So that was Tet.
That was Tet. And then, how did you feel when everything seemed to come to an end?
It was approach avoidance. I really had culture shock for a long time, and I was quite anxious to get on with my life and travel. But I was also deeply affected by leaving. I mean, I can't say I regretted leaving on many levels, but the emotional ties to friends and everything, I had trouble with. And when I left, it was very, very, very sad, but because I was young, with some hope. As a matter of fact, I was interviewed by a hometown newspaper, you know, after I got back. I took a trip around the world, and basically, you know, I visited all these countries and finally got back to the New York area. And I guess it was 1969, and I said, oh, the war's going to be over. I have it on authority. So they, oh, well, he was in Vietnam. Well, of course, you know, 8 years later, the war. But it was more me hoping that it would be over. And that was a big speculation. One was, who's a spook and who's not a spook? Everybody was a spook. You know, everybody worked for the CIA. And the other was, when the war's going to end. And so these were the topics, you know. And so the feeling among the cognoscenti, which meant we didn't know anything, was it was going to end very soon after I left. And of course it didn't.
But, and how did you feel in 75 when that war ended?
Terrifically relieved, and then angry at a lot of my friends. I had gotten involved in lefty politics. I kind of did it ass backwards. I went to Vietnam and then got involved in lefty politics and a gay liberation and stuff. And so there were some very hardcore leftists who said, how can you be happy about this? Or no, you should be happy. Oh, I wasn't happy. Because some of my friends who were here, and then some of I thought were going to be killed and all that, and they said, aren't you happy that communism won? Because that's what you are, that's what we are. I said, no, I don't think I'm a communist. I mean, I don't care. But, you know, no, I'm not that happy, because I know the suffering part, and they thought I was this and that. You know, and they were a bunch of white guys from, you know, so they didn't know shit either. So it was definitely bitter, bitter, bittersweet. And then, of course, a lot of the extremist Vietnamese were here at that time, more so than the quotes, in quotes, boat people and stuff. And they were rabid anti-communists to the point that made me uncomfortable. So then I had, you know, the communist friends or the lefty friends saying, isn't this great? But then I had them on the other side, and I didn't feel like I fit either way. Maybe I fit with that family in Ninh Hoa. Maybe that's who I was. And so, you know, but it was hard to hear Vietnamese trashing the end of the war, which they were doing because they felt it was communist, and then it was hard to hear the friends saying, isn't this great? Because I didn't think, well, the war's over, but I wonder how great it's going to be. I didn't know. And you saw what happened. We were terrifically punitive and terrible. Terrible, yes. Terrible, terrible.
And now everyone's regretting just about everything.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, but all that suffering. And I found out about a program that if you were injured and not a child, but a young adult or something. Mm-hmm. The Vietnamese would come here, be rehabilitated, but they needed volunteers and houses to stay. So I did that.
Was John Bell then there when you went?
You know, I can't remember, but it was like that. And it was always had a kind of a Quaker religious background.
Yeah.
And I never felt after 60 years, you know, I would say that made me the man I am today, 60 years of Catholic school. But I didn't like any of the Orthodox. But these people were comfortable because they seemed non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. How could you be religious and be non-judgmental? But they were. I didn't know. I'm being rhetorical. So I worked with or gave housing to, especially two, who then went back. I never knew what happened. And they were, one was almost paraplegic, and then the other had...
But you were in the States?
Yeah, I was teaching.
So you were at this end of the pipeline that went to Vietnam.
Right. They came here, they got rehabilitated, but then they went back to from war wounds. Uh-huh. And they weren't soldiers. They were,
you
know...
Did you think that experience in the United States was harmful in some ways as well as helpful?
You know, I never thought of it. I didn't have the consciousness. And I mean, I knew some Vietnamese, but they never really opened up, and I never, you know, it was more a companion.
Right, helping.
So I don't know, like, did they want, I do remember one guy really wanted to go home, and I thought that made a lot of sense to me,
yeah.
You know?
There's a big debate over program, because it turned out it was much more politicized than you may have thought.
Yeah.
And
because there's a lot of good people in San Francisco who volunteered.
Oh, yeah.
They always seemed so impressed that I had been in Vietnam, and they were just good people. And, you know, they wanted to help these young
these
people.
Kids,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And do you ever contribute to IVS in the years after?
No.
Or follow anything? Do you get an alumni newsletter?
I read everything. I don't send anything in.
Great.
I know about John Lewis, and he writes me letters every so often. Mm-hmm. Which is nice, and I know Chris and Twee in Berkeley, and I run into John Llewellyn, who's he and his wife are in the Green Party.
Where are they?
Mendocino.
Oh.
They raise seaweed, and I think he ran for president in the Green Party.
On the Green Party? You know, you couldn't happen to get. I mean, if I call back sometime, could I get John's telephone number?
Yeah, you can.
Can
I can try. Why don't you just call the Green Party headquarters?
Where we said San Francisco.
It's all over. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Green Party. See what happens.
Okay,
and then if you try me, and then a friend of mine, Betty Wilkinson, who was right there before, she's here.
Yeah.
We're kind of estranged now, but we, you know, we were very, very, very close. Anyway, so because Brian Tate.
I have her. Jay Scarborough gave me.
Yeah.
Says hi.
Yeah.
He gave me her number. And,
right. And then Carolus Deal is here.
Uh-huh. Oh, actually, I don't know.
No, it's a guy.
I said,
you want to talk to this guy? He said no, but...
Oh, good. Okay.
All right. Yeah. But and he was Betty's friend, too. He went to Vietnam right after I left. See, Betty was there, then the Tet Offensive came, plus she was shelled in Mitaw because she worked with nurses, and so she just had it. So she left on her own. When we had that opportunity to leave, she left on her own. She went to the Philippines for a year, and then she got a Fulbright and went back to Dalat. So her Vietnam experience wasn't exclusively IBS.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And
for several people also.
Yeah. And that's all I remember.
You mentioned the thing about MPs, that you had a...
Well, you know, in order to really survive there, it was easier to do black and white. So I was the good civilian with all my wonderful, noble Vietnamese friends. Mm-hmm. And then there was the army, okay? Mm-hmm. And particularly the MPs. And I had a number of bad experiences where, like, a Vietnamese friend and I would be on a bicycle together, especially in Nha Trang. We'd get pulled over. You're breaking the rules. They thought I was a GI, even though I wasn't in uniform. But, you know, you're breaking the rules. There's no fraternization. I'd say, I'm a teacher. And I'd show them this little IV. What the hell kind of ID is this? You know? And then, the Vietnamese friend was trying to keep the dignity. But So, you know, I was like this one. So one time... I don't remember how it happened. There was a bunch of MPs doing something, kind of harassing the Vietnamese or something like that, or one of my friends, and I was going by the bike. I said, "Fuck you, asshole." Well, they came over and they stopped me. And I said, "I'm a civilian, you can't do anything." "Oh yeah, well, we never heard of such a thing." And then the Vietnamese love a distraction, especially American on American.
Mm-hmm.
So these were enormous GIs from the South, probably with the red beefy faces and the thing. And I'm going, "You know what we want? We want you to get out of the country." And you can't arrest me and everything. Yeah. And so they got the Vietnamese cops to arrest me. And the Vietnamese didn't know what the hell they were doing. Nobody knew what they were doing. But I tell you, the town was very entertained.
Mm-hmm.
And my heart was beating just as fast, but, you know, and they took me to some headquarters. And, of course, finally they like, released me. But I really think that's the closest I came to death in Vietnam. I think that they would have killed me. Because I was spouting a line, you know, naively, but I was sincere.
Mm-hmm.
And they never, also the element of surprise. I mean, who the hell was I? So... That was it. That was the biggest. But it took like all day before I was finally released. It was a comedy of errors that could have resulted in something bad.
Yeah.
Even though on film, if the internet was film, you know.
Well, Dick Peters said that when this reporter, who was former IBS, would try asked him to do something. Anyway, the point was he punched him. You know, he was screaming.
The MP punched him?
No. A former IBSer, a newsman, was screaming at Dick, and Dick hit him. And he immediately apologized and said, "I'm sorry."
Yeah.
You know, tempers ran and emotions ran so high.
Oh, and people were killed there for other reasons in the war. You know, you blame on the wars.
Well, that's the last thing I'd like to touch upon, just for my own interest, because I knew David. But what was your read on that?
I hadn't been in the country that long.
Mm-hmm.
I felt a tremendous identification and empathy, even though I didn't know this guy. I felt very bad, very sad, and whether it was the circumstance and how it was related to me by probably people that had been there for a while, it could have been John Lewis, that was the beginning of my edification that it was not as black and white as everybody thought, that most likely he was killed because he spoke out against the corrupt Vietnamese government, which we were ostensibly there to say was okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was my Newark. It wasn't that hard. It wasn't a stretch. I just needed to be informed or witness it. And so it crystallized it. And then from then on, I knew that even if there was Vietnamese soldiers who were supposed to protect me, that they weren't so great, and that they blew up orphans, and it wasn't just the VC. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the one or two North Vietnamese soldiers that I came into contact with, one was in a hospital and whatever, I was really impressed by their discipline, and I don't know what to say, they were a class act, the NVC, you know, whatever, even though they're supposed to be the enemy and stuff like that. And then I saw such horrible behavior in terms of the GIs, you know. And in terms of the gay experience, you know, I was gay, wasn't out, although I think everybody knew, and you know, was not affirmed yet. And after about 9 months there, after the diarrhea cleared up, you know, all my normal appetites came back, and I did have many, many relationships, sexual and affectional, with Vietnamese. And I guess I made this rule that I wouldn't do it with any white guy or something, or meaning soldier, meaning military. And I got hit on by military. There was a lot of gay shit happening. A lot of the MPs apparently were. But I also got harassed because one time there was nothing else to do but stay in a BOQ. Mm-hmm. And I guess the guy at the desk, because of my funny ID, and I guess he just plugged.